People of Earth, give hope.
Give hope. We pray, we pray, give hope.
Hi, I'm Willa.
I'm Marla.
And we are the Gig Hoes. Marla, who's in the chair?
Oh, we have the fabulous Tia Clark all the way from downtown Manhattan.
Wow, she's cooler than us. We live in Queens.
She's very cool.
I know. Hey, Tia, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great. It's good to see y'all.
Yeah, you too. Last time we were all playing in a very strange resort situation in Port St. Lucie.
But good thing Tia was there because we had a lot of heavy metal requests that night, right?
That's right.
Freebird, of course.
Freebird, of course.
We had to play it like every other song.
Oh, God, I know.
Yeah.
Guys with long beards.
Like Florida, dudes in camo.
Yeah.
One Freebird was not enough. I think they would have, if we had played it twice in one night, I think they would have been into it.
Yeah, that's why I kept telling them it wouldn't happen till the end, because I knew.
Yeah.
I knew. Yeah. All right. So I'm just going to say this about Tia. She's a killingly great guitar player and singer. Just amazing.
And so bass player, which you haven't sampled yet.
I haven't even.
Yeah.
But it's going to be part of your origin story. We're going to find out because both your parents were pro musicians, right?
They were. Still are. Yeah.
Still are.
And then by your 20s, you were already playing in punk bands.
Yes.
Did you have your hair up in sticks and stuff?
Oh, gosh. I didn't have the discipline for that. No, it was more like a lack of hair care in that era.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Or just let it go greasy.
Yeah. It was just,
bordering on grunge.
Yeah. It's like van touring. You shower when you can. It's not always right. The vibe where you're staying.
Right. The French, about the French shower, right?
Oh, okay. Wait, can I say this? Like the whore's bath?
Yes. Pits and pubes. Okay, but more recently, she's been playing with this metal band called Liturgy. Oh, more. All right. Okay, so these are all different bands that I'm looking at this.
Yeah, and some of them are, recent past. Yeah.
I love this. Judas Priestess. That's great.
They're so cool. That was like an honor.
Was it Judas Priest covers?
Yes, it's
wow.
Exactly what it sounds like.
Girls?
It's all female.
Right.
Judas. I was like kind of aware of them from way back, so it was like this huge honor to play a few shows with them. They're amazing.
Wow. Reservoir Dogs, DAWGS.
Yeah, that's current. That's a 90s tribute cover band.
And you toured Japan, Europe, Australia, the U.S. and Canada in the past year.
It's been a year. It's been the craziest year I've ever had, yes.
Oh, my God, that's insane. And were you playing, like, big venues, little venues, all of the above?
It was, like, mostly 200 to 300 cap small clubs, and then we did some festivals that were, like, thousands.
Wow.
200 to 300
people, yeah.
Oh, people. I'm thinking shows. Oh, my God.
I mean, maybe that many. No, not that many shows. It was probably, like, 50 or 60 shows, give
that's
or take.
Enough.
It's a lot.
Wow. And then you sort of decided you had enough of the road recently?
I mean, I think maybe you guys can relate to this. I think playing someone else's original music on a loop for that long,
absolutely.
As much as, you can have a lot of love for the people you're doing it with and think the music is great and the lifestyle and the creative aspect of it can just not work for you anymore.
Sure.
So
think of how lucky we are because, the people that created it can only play that music over
right.
and over. They can't play like, switch bands,
yeah.
but we
they can't
just
play Freebird.
No, totally.
the dream. I'm living the dream.
But it's like, I like the variety. Like I heard a couple of other guests on the podcast say that. I look at people that just know every tune off the top of their head and I'm just like, I want that.
But you are that person.
You're getting
that's
there.
That's why you're, not to like pat ourselves on the back, but it's like you're in that league and you're a lot younger than us and you just amaze me every time.
Oh, yeah. I really appreciate it. I feel like I'm very much still working on it. I'm just like happy to be in the room.
Yeah. Well, we're happy to have you in the room and, it's a lifelong endeavor. It never ends because people keep writing songs and then we have to learn them.
Yeah.
All right.
Just keep discovering more.
So tell me how this all began. Tell me about your childhood.
Oh, man. Oh, heavy.
Only child,
yeah. So my parents are both musicians to this day.
Right. What do they play?
Still working. My mom's a violinist, and my dad's a composer. He Ooh. Does sort of like 20th century, like new music.
Oh, wow.
Guitar,
is it the stuff that sounds like an accordion's falling down the stairs?
It's a wide variety. I mean, he does, you know, some sort of Brazilian jazz arrangements. He's like a very diverse, very diverse guy. So he plays like a bunch of every instrument and, you know, was my first guitar teacher and stuff.
Right.
And yeah, so my parents are ex-Mormons from Utah.
Wow.
And so they moved here in the 70s.
Ex-Mormons.
To like, I guess, play jazz and not be Mormon anymore.
Wow, that's amazing.
One extreme to the other. Awesome.
So yeah, it was wild. They just kind of found an apartment in Inwood, all the way uptown.
Cool. So they were in Manhattan right away.
Right. Although it was like that kind of at the time felt like the ends of the earth.
Sure.
My mom actually sent me a picture of like they're building a luxury development down the block from where I grew up, but it was like a really different place in the 90s.
I bet. And so, what was your first instrument?
Voice. Yeah, and I don't know if my parents were necessarily like consciously angling to have me be a musician from birth, but it was just all we did in the house because it was like what they slept and breathed. So actually, a Polaroid of my dad holding me at the piano when I was 20 years old. 20 minutes old.
Oh, 20 minutes. Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't even remember what I was doing at 20 years old. No, I'm like a literal newborn.
Give me that kid. I'm horny.
Oh my God.
I thought you were going to say 20 months. Right.
No, 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
There you go.
Yeah. So I was like singing a lot from childhood. And then I was kind of like made to play piano until I was 12. But that just never really took.
Uh-huh.
I tried out pretty much everything we had in the house, like clarinet, cello. I tried the violin a little bit. Just, you know, drum kit. Like we had all this stuff on hand.
Yeah. It's like a wonderland for a musician, right?
Yeah, it was crazy. And also like they homeschooled me until I was 10 or 11.
So
I was kind of just like up in this stuff all the time.
Wow. So what's that like? I mean, did you have friends? Did you socialize?
No, there were like people in my neighborhood and there was like a support group for homeschoolers at the time.
Right.
You know, so a bunch of like hippies would bring their kids together and let them play.
Right.
And they would do field trips and stuff.
But you were like one of the only musicians that you knew, right?
It was definitely still like, it was a little scattered.
You had your parents to relate to in that realm. But...
Yeah.
So when did you decide on guitar?
I was probably around 10 and it was like Nirvana and that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up around a lot of like, my mom was in Broadway Pit, so I heard a lot of musical stuff.
Oh.
And then, you know, my dad was like super into jazz fusion. So I was like, you know, around all this different music. But then when like rock music was really in the center around 90, 91, I was just like, yeah, this is for me. This is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I picked up guitar then and that was like pretty much it.
Right. You know, it's so funny. So your parents are into all this sophisticated music and then this primal comes on. And, yeah, that's it.
I think that was like, my way of being myself a little more. My dad especially might have liked to turn out a classical soprano or a violinist or like someone that would work with his music.
Right.
And that just like didn't happen.
But when I met you, I thought, like you said, you didn't come into the band that you were in with me as a bass player. But I remember you saying you played bass, But when I heard you play guitar, I was like, oh, we need her on guitar.
I mean, I think it's probably a pretty common tale. Like, everybody always needs a bass player.
Oh,
you know?
So was that a necessity?
It was always out of necessity. And it's just, you kind of get cooler opportunities. And the band I joined in high school, which I was in some version of that band for about 10 years, it was like already fully formed. There were like two guitarists and a drummer and a singer. And it's always just sort of like, oh, we can have a girl bassist.
Oh, right. You know, like
so it was special.
I think that's like what happens.
Right.
And like being
so not only a bass, but a girl bass. Right?
Yeah. And I'm in the semi-pro or hobbyist or the realm of teenagers. If you play guitar well and then you pick up bass, you sound like you're awesome at it. And when, in fact, you know, I wasn't. But
right. Like, right. Because there's less notes to play when you're playing the bass.
Yeah. But you're flashier, you know. So I think that definitely like kept happening. And I was like, well, everybody always seems to need a bassist. And if the question is like, well, we need a bassist, do you want to go to Europe? The answer is going to be yes.
Yeah. I mean, we know a lot of guitar players that play bass also.
Right. I mean, I'm just glad that first band I met you in happened just so I could meet you.
Yeah, what was that band, Marla?
Well, it was a Donna Summer tribute band. It was
that.
Of recent vintage. And it kind of just, we started out hot and it just kind of like...
Got
just
cold.
faded gradually into the depths of nowhere.
Yeah, but everybody I met, that was like such a turning point experience because I was just starting to kind of gig in that realm.
Right.
And it was like to see these people at that skill level gigging, women especially, you know.
It was
like,
good, right.
Yeah, it was really like everybody I met in that, you know, like you and Zoe Grella, amazing drummer, just like this whole part of the business that I had not like been
and
in
Long
myself.
Island,
yeah, the
probably,
whole Long
have
Island.
Have you been to Long Island before
I mean,
then?
I'd been, but I had no idea how like rich the music music scene was out there, like right. how much work there was and what types of music.
And you
could,
didn't mention the group she's in now, which is the utmost important.
Oh, right.
Mm, the Bangles.
Yeah. The Bangles, yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of the main thing I'm doing now. It's a tribute to the Bangles and the Go-Go's.
I love that name, the Bangles. Right. So good. So what was your first paying gig?
Ooh, that's such a funny question. I mean, I do remember I did a few things with my parents back in the day. Like, we did a concert at the local public school, which is very weird.
Of his music?
Of just, like, covers and stuff.
Like, music?
Kid-friendly, yeah. I remember we did, like, some Elvis or something, you know.
Right.
That kind of thing.
But they didn't pay you for that.
I think we did get paid for that. I think I got a little bit of money for that. Uh-huh. And then I think I won a talent competition as a kid once. And I think maybe there was a prize or something for that.
Was that through your school or through the radio?
It was just something my parents found and signed me up for. I was like 7 or 8.
For singing,
right. Yeah. And then,
Do you remember what you sang?
I actually don't. Probably Whitney Houston. I loved Whitney Houston.
Right. Yeah. So. Makes sense.
Oh, good to know. We're going to call some Whitney Houston songs next time.
I mean, we're going to key that down a little bit, but sure.
You don't need to key it down. I heard you sing.
It depends on how long the set is.
And then, so when was your first gig without your parents?
Ooh. Around my junior year in high school, I had a band with my two best friends in high school where I just kind of showed them bass and drums and we would play the school talent show or whatever. But the band I got into in high school with people I met at a guitar camp that I went to over the summer. It was like a little more serious. Uh-huh. So we played, CBGB used to have a teen audition night.
Oh, wow.
So we actually played CBGB a couple of times.
Wow. What year was that, do you know?
Probably like 99, 2000.
And your parents like never went with you. Like you were like on your own right from the beginning or like when you were 19, 20?
Most of the time, yeah, they would come to some gigs, but it was mostly just us and our one guitarist's mom would drive us around in the minivan. She was really sweet.
And this is just a side note, but like you do this all without driving and owning a vehicle. And she gets to gigs on the train with
Incredible.
Her amp.
Incredible.
You know, pick me up by the 49th Street stop, you know. And she gets there. She's never late.
It's incredible.
Yeah. It's just like a New York City thing. I mean, I'm like a few weeks away from my road test right now.
Right.
I don't know if I'll ever make the leap to being a car owner in New York, but it's good to have the option.
Well, you've made it all this time with that one. That's kind of amazing. It truly is. It truly is. I mean, I remember I had a whole thing with my parents because my brother, in the first year that he had his license, he crashed the car 3 times.
Oh, my God.
And he was 3.5 years older than me. So, like, they, in the worst way, they did not want me to drive. So I thought I was late to the party, and I was 22 when I got my license.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I think in a weird way, it's harder when you have a 40-year-old sense of consequences. I think if I had learned to drive at 16, I'd have heard it, I'd have been like, yeah, this is great.
Right.
But now I'm like, oh, God, dogs, children, tickets. Like
bad drivers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still hard. I mean, my mother had a license and didn't really drive till she was 60.
Wow.
After my father died, you know, because
yeah.
you're still skidder. I'm not going to drive on Fordham Road. It was this busy road.
Oh,
in the Bronx,
yeah. Yeah, scary. Yeah.
Yeah, my friend didn't get her license until she was 64. And then the first thing she did, Claire, she got an RV and she toured the Vancouver Islands by herself, sleeping in the RV.
I've got a car. I mean, go anywhere.
Maybe it wasn't an RV, maybe it was a van, but yeah. Whatever. Okay, so what's the strangest gig you've ever done?
Ooh.
I mean, there's probably more than one, but...
Strangest. Okay, I was thinking in terms of best and worst. Strangest. There were definitely a lot of, in my 20s, touring with the punk band, a lot of basements and small spaces and stuff like
basements.
That. Yeah, basements. And
like basement clubs?
No,
just
people's basements.
Wow.
And that would be, for some reason, I think about this now and I'm just like, what were we exactly trying to prove? But like, we were each touring with 3, 4 by 10 or 12 speaker cabinets a piece. So 9 cabinets.
Up and down the steps?
For a 4-piece band, up and down the steps every single day.
Wow.
And then staying with people, like very rarely staying in like a hotel and basically just making negative money. You know,
negative
like,
money, right.
There's a nice sense of community in punk shows. So it's like people are often really cool to you. It's a party. It's fun. But I definitely remember it was a pass the hat. Like I remember particularly one night in the South, we were partially paid with a loose cigarette and a Subway punch card that was one sticker from being filled in.
Wow. Oh, my God. So
it's worse than us.
So what were you doing to make money?
I've been teaching guitar since I was a teenager, that's, I know a lot of musicians do this.
Very lucrative.
Yeah, like especially...
How many students you have?
Oh, right now, probably in the 30 range.
That's lucrative.
That is lucrative.
2020, when everybody was home, I was sometimes doing over 40 lessons in a week, which was definitely too many.
But you're a gig ho like the rest
of us. Yeah, so. I was like, I was so afraid, you know, for the future of work. And it was also, it felt like very meaningful because sometimes I would be like the only person that my student would talk to all day, you know. So it was kind of, I liked doing it in a way, but it was definitely like I couldn't keep up that pace. But yeah, there were always music lessons going on in my house. My parents would have students over to our two-bedroom, and so I kind of got a feel for teaching. I would take beginner guitar students occasionally, and that was
the runover from your parents, right?
Yeah. And as a teenager, nothing is going to pay you as well. And I had no other skills, so I was babysitting, and then I was teaching guitar.
All right, I mean, you were going, all right, you being homeschooled. Oh, at 10, you started going to regular school?
11, yeah, sixth grade, I went to performing arts high school.
And who made that decision? Like, you just said, Ma, I want to see other kids.
I definitely wanted to go to school.
And they let you, cool.
Yeah, they found, but public schools near us were not great at the time.
Yeah, right, like, I'm sure. Yeah.
They found it, you know, we applied for scholarship and all that, and I found a spot.
And then... Did you love it? Did you hate it? Were you sorry you did it? Were you glad?
I was definitely, I think, glad in the long term. If anything, I wish I had gone sooner. I got a lot of amazing things at home, just like musically, and also just hanging out with musicians and adults, because I was portable. Right. You know, like my parents would take me, like I would be sitting sometimes in the break room at Miss Saigon or whatever, doing homework.
Because your mom was in the pit.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. One of my childhood friends that I'm still friends with, we met at our parents' mutual rehearsal, and I have this memory of us like running in and out of these theater seats while our parents like were, you know, so I was like everywhere.
What a life.
What a story.
That's amazing. Wow. This is, I'll say it again. I love doing this podcast because of this. You just never.
Everyone's God. Life. And what everyone's life. Just so unique. I mean, that's the thing about what we all do. You
that's
know,
right.
We have our own little road that we follow and you never know.
Wow.
You just never know where it's taking you.
All right. So at what point, I mean, do you consider yourself, you're still making more money teaching than doing gigs?
Yeah, it's probably still like, depending on the season and the month, like 60-40, 70-30.
Right.
But since I kind of had my punk band that I was with for a long time broke up in my late 20s. And I kind of thought that like, that was it for me. I was like, okay, like for this style of music, like I'm too old.
Right.
That was my shot. The guitarist who was very talented left to join a bigger band.
Right. Well, and that happens.
And it happens. Yeah. But I think I took it really hard at the time. And then I like got into a relationship and just like stepped back from music and was teaching and did just sort of domestic stuff for a few years.
And
that was great for a while, but also like in a way I was really unhappy. Like every time I would go to someone else's gig, I would get really upset. Like I wasn't fulfilled not playing music. And then, wait, I forget what the original question was.
At what point did you consider yourself a professional musician?
Oh, yeah.
That was the question.
So basically, I had this really insane few months where I was living with this boyfriend. I kind of thought it was a more permanent relationship than it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
never heard that before.
I mean, good dude, we're cool. But occasionally gigs would cross my path and a few times an email had come around like, oh, this all-female Guns N' Roses tribute really needs an Izzy. And I had just said no to it a bunch of times. And I was like, I don't think I'm in shape or good enough. You know, like playing-wise, I was just like, I don't know if I can really do this. And then finally I remember my boyfriend at the time kind of nudged me. He's like, are you sure you don't want to do it? And I was like, all right, fine, fuck it. Let's, you know.
Yeah.
And so I learned all the songs in like maybe a week and a half. And and I played one show with them and I was like, oh, like maybe this is actually a realm. I had never thought about being in a tribute band or any of that stuff. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. The musicians were really good. I had a really good time doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 months, my boyfriend had dumped me and I was riding around Canada with this band.
Wow.
And I moved into like a roommate situation with three random women who were actually really lovely, but matched with me by a realtor.
Wow. This is a Netflix movie you're describing.
It was such
a
weird, like my life was exactly the same for about 5 years as far as my job and what I did every day, and then it completely flipped around. And then from that tribute I got another, the 90s tribute that I still play in, because I was publicly doing that sort of work, and then I just started saying yes to everything. So I realized, like, if you're good past a certain point, you just have to like really grind to learn whatever music you need to learn.
I'm still stuck, my brain is still stuck on, I learned the Guns N' Roses repertoire in a week and a half. I mean, that stuff is not so easy.
Well, I was like familiar with it from listening to it as a kid, and it was also like, it's not the Slash solos. Like, Like, I don't know. The band already had a Slash. So it was definitely some complex parts and stuff, but I did not have to memorize all that, you know.
And the shredding stuff. She has a great capacity for songs, as we, you know, she demonstrates all the time.
Yeah, totally,
you know?
That is true.
I mean, some of the songs we played a couple of weeks ago, you haven't played in...
Forever.
Maybe.
Because we do the same thing, but when I see someone your age like that and pulling out stuff that... Where have you ever played this?
There were definitely a couple I tapped out. Like, I went back to that James Taylor tune, Your Smiling Face, and I was like, I could not, like, find a good enough chart
modulating.
For that. Exactly. I was like, this is a cool tune. Like, I'm going to go back and learn that.
I wasn't willing to try that one.
I sing it, so that's why I kind of know. But I had to change keys for Larry, so it wasn't easy.
No, it didn't. It was less than pristine.
Yeah, you know. So were a lot of things that week. That's why when I edit the video, I just take the good parts.
Yeah. So, Tia, tell me about your worst gig ever.
There were a lot of, it's so funny to think about. Playing in a punk band is really thankless. A lot of the time you're playing for like 8-10 people in the middle of, you know, there's such a small sect of people that like that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And even then there's no guarantee that the crowd will like, if there's a crowd at all, like what you're doing specifically.
And if they don't, are they very vocal about that?
Yeah. A lot of the time, or a lot of the time places just don't understand what they're getting into. There was this, maybe there still is, but there was this bowling alley in Minneapolis called Memory Lanes. That's always how you want to hear a story start, right? And they would just hire any band to play in the afternoon. And in 2008, money, it paid pretty well for a band like us. I think we got like 120 or 150 bucks for the whole band. But it was like, okay, that's gas in the van.
For how long? Like one set?
Our sets were always like 45 minutes. Yeah, like it was a short. Right. The bands like that, I guess, never play for that long. Mm-hmm. But it was like, you're just playing to whoever's at the bowling alley in the middle of the afternoon. And they don't want to see a punk band. So right in the beginning
Throw off their hook shot, right?
Yeah, like we're lucky that we didn't get, like bowling balls thrown at us or something. So at the beginning of the show, I had this used, very used, like it looked like it was backline at a club. Like it had a club's address on it, like Galen Kruger bass head that I loved.
Ooh.
And so it's being carried around with like no road case, no nothing, like barely knew how an ATM worked at this point in my life. So right in the beginning of the show, I guess a washer had gotten loose and was rattling around inside of the bass head. And I guess it got hot, as I learned later, landed on the circuit board. So the amp stopped working immediately and smoke came out of it.
Wow.
So that was like the beginning.
And then
that was how the gig began.
Yeah, that was how the big, it was like within the first couple of songs.
I know.
And then, so we borrow a bass amp, and actually I still am in,
who'd you borrow the bass amp?
Just from one of the other bands on the bill. They were friends of
ours. Oh, there were more bands than you.
Right. Yeah, okay. There were more bands than us, and friends of ours, still some people I'm like still in touch with, super cool people.
And this, is in the bowling alley.
Yeah, and this was always a good tour stop, because it was like, okay, whatever Memory Lanes is, like we know we're going to get a guarantee there, and we never had that.
Right.
So then we're just playing this really loud, abrasive music for people in a bowling alley. Mm. And there's like a suburban mom coming up to us, like clapping her bowling shoes over her head and mouthing, "You suck," at us. And so we just finish our set and like everybody hates it. And then this, our drummer at the time had his friend come and drive us. She was really cool. And she's talking to some guy after the set. And, like, he's hitting on her. And she, like, rebuffs him. And then before he walks away, he's just like, "By the way, your music, it fucking sucked."
Wow.
And she was like, "Why don't you suck my dick?" And he was like, "You don't have a dick. And if you did, I would not suck it."
Wow.
And that was the end of the evening.
That's lovely. So
he had the nerve to, retort.
After,
you know.
Wow.
Amazing. You don't have a dick. I showed you.
That's great.
Yeah. That was a wild one.
Those kind of things, they stick in a different part of your brain and you never forget them, right?
Never forget them.
Oh, God. Wow. And were you just completely demoralized?
We were used to it. Honestly, we got that response a lot with the three speaker. Like, we played some rock and roll bar in Memphis where, like, we were so loud. They were just like, "You have to stop playing or we're going to call the police."
How long was this band together for?
On and off with different names. It was always myself and the guitar player on and off with different iterations for, like, 10 years.
Wow. That is some commitment.
Yeah, we really kept it going. And there were certain little enclaves of places in big cities and in New York where people really liked it. And it was a cool time.
I imagine the Lower East Side, right?
And Williamsburg before it was what it is now.
Okay, you have more strength than me. I don't think I could last 6 months getting that kind of reception from people. I mean, did you really enjoy playing the music?
I really believed in the music. And it was sort of like, you imagine maybe doing that stuff that you're going to be sort of some kind of like cult hero,
right,
or whatever. You right. know, there's just like that some small percentage of people will find your music really meaningful. I guess that's the,
right.
you know.
So you're kind of like a
there.
Warrior. You got that warrior mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. I was also always drunk back then. So I think that took, that like took the edge off.
I get that.
When did you stop doing that on gigs? Because I stopped after like the first year or two, and I said, I can't carry my amp
yeah.
if I'm drinking, you know?
Yeah, the window between me starting the Guns N' Roses band and quitting drinking was probably like in the same 4 to 6 month period.
Right.
I was just like, if I want to do this, I can't do that.
Right. Yeah. 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 Well, you know, club dates, it's interesting because you can get away with drinking and getting high on a wedding once you've been doing it for years and years and years, especially if you're in a band where you all know each other's moves. You can kind of get away with it easier than if you're in a real concert setting where people are like...
You know, yeah, I mean, we can get away with it, but like, you know, then
oh, yeah.
you're like, ugh, I got to carry this thing.
And well, yes, like, at a certain point it becomes...
It becomes not worth it.
Yeah, you know? The older you get.
But, I mean, even the free drink part of it, you know, it's free.
Well, yeah, that was a big problem.
It's a big incentive. It's free.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was like the best gig you ever did?
Oh, man. I mean, there have been a lot of good ones. Even though I'm not doing the touring metal band anymore, we played some festivals that were really fun.
So like how many people are at a festival?
Anywhere from like 2,000 or 3,000. So I think the biggest one we did was like maybe a crowd of like 8.
8,000.
That's Primavera Sound in Spain.
Right. Yeah, that's exciting.
That is exciting.
Yeah.
And then now you've done it. So now you can like, okay, I've done it.
That's like, that's a rush. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a really yeah. crazy experience.
And they were into it. So it's not like when they, you know, said you suck.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's at least people like stop by your stage at a festival. They're at least curious,
right.
you know, so you
right.
get some kind of connection with the crowd and that's always fun.
Wow. I mean, I've never played to that many people ever. I can't even imagine just the adrenaline of having that many people cheering for you, right?
Yeah, it's really wild. It's not a sustainable lifestyle. At least it was not for me personally, but I'm like glad I had the experience.
Right. Yeah, especially being in exotic locales.
Yeah.
You know, Spain. I do have friends that toured a lot with big bands and, you know, it was a thing in club dates. The guy who had just been on tour for like 2 years with Billy Joel, right? And now he's back doing weddings. And these people, you know, I felt for them in a way and I hated them in
who
another
was it?
Way.
Can you say?
No, there's a bunch of people like I remember, but okay. I remember their faces, but not their names.
Sure.
Because I didn't know them. But they were so resentful of doing weddings and they missed the spotlight and all that, you know.
Yeah, there's some sax player that says, oh, I played with Billy Joel. And then if you call him, you feel like, well, I'm not good enough for you to play with,
and
you know.
And he flusters that attitude, too. So part of me was like, well, screw you, pal. Do you know the horror? No, I don't know the horror. Well, then you're not of any use to me on some level, you
of
know.
Of course, yeah.
But I get it.
The horror. Other.
You know
you
what
know
I mean?
The
do you know the horror?
I mean, how long do I have to...
she'll shred it in a week and a half.
D minor, that's all you need to know.
Perfect.
D yeah. minor and F minor.
Yeah. And, were you ever in a situation where, I mean, for you it's different because you were joining bands, but were you ever in a situation where whoever was in charge made life bad for you, either talked down to you or cursed you out because you didn't know things the way they wanted you to know them or anything
or sexual
like that?
Advances,
yeah,
unwanted.
Harassment.
Ooh,
because you were in a lot of girl situations.
I was in a lot of girl, and yeah, when I was in my 20s, it was always I was the only girl, but they were like friends. You know, so it was sort of like traveling around with a bunch of older brothers.
Oh.
So I was like lucky in that respect. Mm-hmm. I found like in tour situations, communication stuff is definitely hard because you usually have the person in charge of, say, like band leader mm-hmm. is so driven to get their thing on the road that like they can maybe, you know, not stop for meals without feeling it, or like maybe right. they're not communicative about when you're waking up, then you know there's
right.
like there's always a vibe of like you're on 5 hours sleep and you're staying up until 2 and
right.
And I think that's just kind of like the nature of the, I don't think it's any like one person being an asshole. It's just kind of like the nature of that
well,
type of work.
It's like the fact that we're always working for someone else. We have like a different lord. You
right.
know, like
totally.
I mean, it's the same thing
yeah.
for you. You
yeah.
know, it's like you're used to dealing with, okay, now what's going to be the thing with this person? You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's always something.
Well, like
I mean,
Bob
rarely it's
like
not.
Like Bob Dylan says, everyone's got to serve somebody.
Yes, it is.
So did you ever have any desire to write your own stuff?
I have, on and off. I had like an original band where, you know, I collabed, wrote with a friend, and that's dormant right now because she just moved upstate. So like on and off, I'm really enjoying the covers lifestyle right now. Right.
And she's got all those students. She just moved.
Right. Just, and plus, covers to you is still novel, right?
It's still very novel. I'm only like a few years in. I'm sure I'll make original music again at some point, but I have no desire to promote it or tour on
any
of that stuff.
The writing is easy. The rest is sucky.
Yeah, I would want to do it in a weird way. Like, I feel like, you know, I always had I had this weird identity crisis throughout my whole early adulthood of, did I pick music or was it just sort of forced on me and whatever?
Yeah.
And I like for there to be a little separation between, okay, like the gig stuff I do, like I love it and I really treasure like the connections there, but it's also like it's a job.
Mm-hmm. It's a job.
Yeah. And if I were to make original music, I would want it to be completely, you know, outside of
no
the
expectations. I can do whatever I want. Exactly.
Yeah, non-monetized.
Right.
Feel and the same way.
I totally feel the same way. Yeah.
You know, that's our space. You know? Yeah. No lord. Or our own lord.
Right. Or lordess.
Lordess.
So is there any just particular story that you're thinking of that I haven't put into a category that you would like to tell us?
Ooh, I mean, I guess worst gig was one thing, but I guess the wildest, scariest gig. Well, the gig itself was fine, but just the surrounding. Because, you know, most gigs are just like pretty mundane. It's like you have a nice time and you go home and that's great. And I was like, yeah, there's like the one story about leaving New Orleans in the middle of the night.
Okay.
So with the punk
band. Sounds good already.
With the punk band, you know, we had
the punk band that they hated at the at the bowling alley.
Yes, that they hated across America.
Missouri.
I just, you know, when you get done, I want to tell a story about a bowling alley gig in New Orleans, too, but go right ahead.
Oh, man. Yeah, so we had this drummer at the time. He had some friend of a friend of a friend host us in New Orleans. And
you mean that's where you were staying, or that's where you were playing?
Where we were staying.
Okay.
And there was a lot of that in the punk community of just, like, you know, someone who knows someone who's willing to put up a band.
Right.
Nice guy. Huge dude with, like, a giant scar across his face. and this, if anybody's familiar with the band Flipper, he had this big fish tattoo on his belly where, like, the eye of the fish was his belly button. And he's really nice and fun. This was a little bit after Katrina, so, like, New Orleans had seen better days.
Right.
And he lived in this sort of garage that was right on the street. And so we're like, okay, like, we can stay here. I notice, you know, when we come in, he's got this giant length of rope in his house just sitting there. And I was like, okay. But, you know, friend of a friend, whatever. So we have a good time. Like, he sneaks us into this fancy hotel's rooftop pool through the stairwell. We're, like, doing fun stuff that afternoon.
Wow.
We play just, like, a whatever, small club, small bar show. Not that many people at it. We end up at a strip club. It was totally, like, not, you know, I was, like, up for the adventure. You know, it wasn't like, oh, we're going to drag you to a strip club. It was fine. I remember just having this really overpriced thimble of a drink and, like, this tiny plastic dentist cup and watching two girls with a bed set up on the stage having a pillow fight.
Wow.
Like, that was the act. And they obviously thought it was hilarious. So I was like, okay, this is not
as
depressing.
You mean the band thought it was hilarious?
No, the girls doing the thing thought it was hilarious.
Drunk.
They were probably friends and just, yeah, whatever, this is so stupid. Like, pay me. And I was like, okay, that's, like, more wholesome than I thought it was going to be. So at some point, the guy, I think, given us a key or told us how to get back into his house. So he disappears and leaves some garbled voicemail of, like, I don't know, he hit his head or just had some like, wild night. And so we go back to the place, and it's basically almost like sleeping on a concrete floor. I had this one of those inflatable camp mats on that tour. And apparently someone looks in the freezer for some reason, and there's a bunch of drugs and a gun.
Oh, God.
Well, I thought, like, a head, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking of our hands. Yeah.
So, like, somehow, I mean, this just goes to show, like, how little a sense of developed consequences I had in my mid-20s.
Wow. But I like the way you said, all right. You know, like, there's a head in the... All right.
Like, that would have just been like, we're leaving right now. You know, this was more sort of the frog in boiling water of, and I still don't know what he was up to. Like, it might have been fine. He was very nice. But
he had a gun and drugs in
his freezer. So somehow, like, and here's the funny part that haunts me to this day. I fell asleep. I just rolled out my mat and was just like, yep, well,
all right, I can sleep here. Yeah.
And then, like, you know, eventually, like, one of my bandmates wakes me up at 3 or 4 a.m. and is just like, hey, let's get out of here.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And anywhere.
And so how many hours went by before it occurred to them that maybe you should leave?
It was probably only a couple. I would imagine we got back at 12 or, you know, like maybe one.
Right.
And they couldn't fall asleep. So like they were just sitting
and
there.
And then what'd you do? Go back to the van?
We just got in the car and drove to the next place a little early and just kind of,
Holy shit. And you did this for 10 years off and on, right?
I mean, we weren't doing super long tours. I think the longest tour was like 3-4 weeks absolute max. These would usually be like little 10-day jaunts.
Wow.
And I had a different band that was a duo with one guy where we would drive around in like a Corolla. And that was like less crazy. Yeah.
Was that punk also?
It kind of. That was more avant, you know, proggy kind of stuff.
Jesus Christ. It's so great. Here's my New Orleans story.
Oh, my God.
So I wasn't playing. I was there 3 times for the music fest that they have at the end of April, beginning of May. You know, they take over a racetrack. There's like 70 different locales. Somehow, none of them impinge on the other. And it's all world music, really.
Nice.
Congo Square is all like people from Africa playing their shit. And then there's a gospel tent. And then there's a jazz tent. And then there's a Cajun area.
What tent were you in?
Huh?
What tent?
No, I wasn't playing. I was visiting. I was a spectator with my friend. Yeah. But, so they had the 2 weekends. It's always the last weekend in April, first weekend in May. And in between, all the bands that are in town for the festivals stick around and they play in the clubs.
Oh.
And a lot of the clubs in New Orleans are old houses, you know, that they take over, like Tipitina's and the Maple Leaf. And people just sit on the lawn. They open all the windows. People sit on the lawn. The music comes wafting out. But one of the things is a jam in this bowling alley on Carrollton Avenue called Rock and Bowl. Carrollton's Rock and Bowl. You've heard of
it. I've heard of this, yeah.
And they play in the snack bar area, right? So it's kind of hilarious. Same thing. People are bowling, and then these guys are playing. So one thing that happened is the drummer's the house drummer, right? But the bass player and a guitar player get up, and the guitar player's singing, and they're doing Born Under a Bad Sign. It's one chord, and then it goes to the 5, right? If it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all. And it's just one riff, bum. So they're okay playing the riff. They're singing songs. Every time they get to the 5, they fall apart. They just fall apart.
You can't change the chord.
They
can't change.
Yeah, they only know the one riff. And the drummer was slowly going insane. I could see the steam coming out of his ears. It's like, Jesus Christ, it's only one change, you know? So there's like the snack bar, there are some tables, and there's like a bowl dispenser there, you know, for the near. This guy gets up. He's like a Cajun guy. He's missing a whole bunch of teeth. He's kind of got a scraggly beard. He's playing guitar. He's latched on to me. I was wearing a pretty tight bodysuit or something. He's trying to get to me. I'm backing up. He's playing. He's singing. He keeps trying to get to me, and I keep backing up, you know? And then his big move, like a Bruce Springsteen move, he jumps on top of the bowl dispenser. That was his big rock and roll move. And I was just trying really hard not to laugh hysterically because I felt... I get it, but man, the whole thing was killing me. So that's my,
oh my God.
New Orleans bowling alley story.
You know, 5 is really far away.
Huh?
5 is really far away sometimes.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, you just make me feel like I've led such a sheltered life, honestly.
How lucky you both are you had music parents.
Right.
Teachers. You both had teachers in your house. Because Willa, you know, was like, insisting, teach me piano, because they were teaching her brother piano.
Yeah, I was two when he was 5, and I would go smack the keys while my mother was teaching my brother because I was jealous. Little did I know. Aww. The road is going to lead me down.
My house had a piano in the basement when we bought it, so that's how I began. At least I had that.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to tell us?
I think we covered a lot of stuff. Hopefully this is like good TV.
Oh, wait. I have the one more thing.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Well, the one more thing I ask everybody. So what would you tell, let's see, when was your gig with your parents?
Ooh, probably when I was like 7.
7, okay. And what was the first gig with a band?
Probably 16, 17.
Okay. So what would you tell that 16-year-old girl now, as in any advice for living this life?
Go to law school.
Or should you do it, should you not, should you have done something else? And also, what would you tell other young people thinking about embarking upon a musical career?
Ooh, okay, this is such a good multi-part question. I want to preface this by saying that this is the disclaimer, like any resemblance to persons anywhere, etc., is purely fictional and unintentional.
Okay.
To the 16 or 17-year-old girl, I would say that there is... no such thing as a guy two or three times your age that's just really interested in mentoring you.
So true. Oh, Lordy.
And then I think with the gigging lifestyle, if you really want to do it, you'll know. You know, it's too much of a pain in the ass to do if you don't really like it.
Yeah.
So I think, that's great. You'll self-select out of it if it's not for you.
But then everybody should at least try if they do have the urge.
But yeah, like if you really have,
you know.
If you have the inkling of, yeah, I would have fun doing this, then just go nuts to like be prepared and learn the music. And, you know, I've had a lot of luck. Just being able to sing backing is a thing that I think gets me hired a lot more.
Oh, that you can sing back. Yeah.
Back up in an instrument at the same time.
Yeah.
I think has been a really good skill set.
Right.
Versus, you know, as a kid, I was like, oh, I need to be able to play like better solos. And like, yeah, nobody cares about the guitar
it's
solo.
True.
Like,
that is so true.
Mark Dannenhirsch, who I worked in a band when I was like 19, said, girl piano players are never out of work who sing.
Right.
And,
sing.
And it was like, bing, light bulb. So yeah. Singing is definitely.
Well, I mean,
thing.
Singing drummers are insanely valuable.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got to get Zoe to learn to sing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Would you do it?
Oh, like, would I do
knowing
it all
now,
over again?
Knowing then what you know now, would you still do it?
I mean, if anything, I grew up in, like, a very academic music environment where, like, if you weren't an amazing sight reader, if you didn't play jazz, you were not, like, legit. If I had known sooner that you could make a good living playing pop music,
You would have gone into it sooner.
I wish I would have done that 10 years before I did. I probably would have had a really good time. But I'm happy I'm doing it now.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's interesting because we graduated into that very early because there was, like, a big industry for us. And that's the thing we always say, how lucky we were that we grew up at that time. We could make a middle-class living, and it's just that you weren't exposed to it because you could have been doing it 20 years ago too, you know, unfortunately.
But it was such a nice surprise to be in my early 30s, and like when I got at the time $150 and like a free burger for playing Guns N' Roses songs, I was like, wait, you can get that for this? Like, this is great.
I know, my first gig was $5. I said, or $18. I said, people pay you to sing?
Yeah.
I'm quitting my waitress. Actually, they fired me when they heard me sing. She's not into being a waitress. Who is?
It's kind of amazing. It's very heady when you first discover that you can get paid that much for playing music. It's still kind of amazing.
That's like magic.
It is like magic.
It's like magic.
Well, Tia, it's been great to have you.
So glad.
Thanks for
so
having me.
So much fun.
More gigs to come.
Yeah.
I hope
you're
to see you both.
You're officially gig ho number 3.
Oh, I cannot wait.
You're a certified gig ho now. Yeah. We should, you know, we should make up a t-shirt or something.
Oh, I would rock the shit out of that.
Yeah, I know
town.
You would. You got to think about that. Okay, so we like to say, may your gigs be plentiful.
And may your Wi-Fi signal, GPS, whatever, never falter.
That's right. Mm, and
nice.
Until our next episode, we are
the Gig Hoes. Wait a minute, say it again till you say it with us. We are
the Gig Hoes. Okay, that was great.
The Gig Hoes podcast is produced and recorded by Marla Joe and Willa Basson, also known as
the Gig Hoes.
Thanks to Jeremy Goldberg for opening voiceover.